McGrath. Coming up on 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, a look at the miracle of fertility and conception with an expert from the Mayo Clinic. In part two of today's program, a look at six-word memoirs. Stay with us. Dr. Jensen, thank you so much for your... For the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about the process of conception and the state of being fertile and what people can do, both men and women, to help ensure healthy conception. My guest is Dr. Janie Jensen, who is with the Mayo Clinic, and she is one of the authors of a new book called The Mayo Clinic Guide to Fertility and Conception. And in this very, very interesting book, we are told in really quite fascinating detail how conception happens. And although most of us at least know the basics, most of us have no idea of just what an intricate process in fact is. And certainly most of us have no idea of just how many factors can profoundly affect one's fertility. And so this book is also a very, very helpful resource for someone who cares about such matters, who is in the process of trying to conceive, offering all kinds of tangible, helpful hints on how to, let's say, improve the odds just as much as is possible within our control. Dr. Jensen is a specialist in the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility and the co-director of the In Vitro Fertilization Program at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. She is also an assistant professor at Mayo Clinic College of Medicine and directs the Obstetrics and Gynecology Clerkship for Medical Students. Dr. Jensen, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, good morning. It's great to be here.
Just a quick, somewhat personal question. Did this easily become your area of focus as a doctor, and was it prompted by anything in particular that you would focus your professional energies in this particular field?
Oh, that's a great question, a very thoughtful one, too. And so I will say that going through medical school, and I'm a University of Wisconsin grad, I found myself very drawn to the field of obstetrics and gynecology because many of the patients were similar in age to I was and very healthy, very motivated if they were pregnant, and I found that I could relate to a lot of their problems. And I think with this particular field, so it's a subspecialty of obstetrics and gynecology, the thing that I loved about it is that the science and the technology is moving very quickly, and we're able to really help patients in profound ways where we haven't been able to before. So one example of something that's incredibly rewarding to me and something that wasn't even possible when I graduated from medical school in 2001 is that now we're able to freeze eggs for women. So about a quarter of our practice here at Mayo Clinic is seeing young women who've recently been diagnosed with cancer or another serious medical illness where the treatment that will help them survive and thrive and live a long life is life-saving, but can be potentially fertility damaging. So something that's been so rewarding and exciting, even in my own career up to this point, is being able to see the development of the technology of egg freezing so that we can help these women freeze their eggs prior to when they're going to undergo chemotherapy or whatever treatment they need, and then have them waiting for them to build their family once they're cured.
Hmm. I want to actually, before we talk about the matter of fertility and conception, jump ahead to Chapter 5, which is titled How to Get Pregnant, How Babies Are Made, in which we are really given all kinds of very, very interesting details about that process, the basics of which most of us are acquainted with to some extent. One of the things that was intriguing to me was when you describe this moment in which implantation occurs in the woman's uterus and how a woman will be pregnant for probably a couple of weeks before having any notion at all that they're pregnant. I mean, that there would be no symptoms whatsoever. And then maybe at that point when a woman might notice some interruption in her normal cycles, at that point the fetus is the size of a poppy seed. I was just amazed to read that, although I suppose it makes sense, but it kind of fills me with wonder that we can know as much as we do about this particular process when we are talking about life beginning with something so incredibly tiny.
And I think that that's one thing that still absolutely amazes me, too. So I'll have some of my patients, and I will, you know, even though I love the science and technology that's behind it, but I think every single day I'm also met with a sense of wonder that it's just absolutely incredible. So not every patient needs something really high-tech as in vitro fertilization, for example, but for some couples that do, many times, you know, a year later we'll be sitting there and we'll be talking about having a second baby with that particular family, for example, and we'll just step back and say, oh my gosh, remember when we first met and remember that day when we did the embryo transfer and it went from something that was, you know, kind of abstract, but you know, at one point, you know, you had this baby that we're now sitting in the room with who's, you know, maybe a year old. And this person, you know, we knew so deeply from the beginning and we were there at the absolute moment that baby was placed inside the mom's uterus. It's actually... even outside, just like you suggested, the science and technology, that sense of amazement really never stops with us.
Never gets old.
Which is one of the great things about being part of this field.
I'm sure. In the chapter that follows that, chapter 6, you explore the really central subject of ovulation and fertility signs, and to go into some detail about something I know almost nothing about, namely a woman's menstrual cycle, and this notion of the fertility window. I think that's what you call it, that moment when that window of time in which a woman is most apt to be fertile or able to become pregnant. In the matter of menstrual cycles and so on, how much variation is there from woman to woman in terms of it being a very regular cycle one can track versus someone where that cycle is a bit more unpredictable or where they need to be looking for other signs? How much does that vary from woman to woman?
Well, we know what you said is true, that there the timing is very critical in order to become pregnant. And many people are surprised to find out that an egg is only able to be fertilized for less than 24 hours. So realistically, the opportunity to become pregnant is within a very short window and in each cycle. And the other thing that can be challenging is that if we read the textbook that we had from junior high biology or high school biology, it says that the menstrual cycle on average is 28 days, but that isn't true for every woman. So typically the events in a menstrual cycle are that once the cycle starts, there's always a group of small eggs that are kind of towing the line and competing against each other, but typically only one egg wins the race and gets to be ovulated. Once an egg is ovulated, most women have a very fixed amount of time, which is approximately 14 days, that their body basically waits around to see if they're pregnant or not. If they're not pregnant, a period comes and the race starts again. But even though that second part, that waiting period, is fixed at 14 days for most women, the lead up or the amount of time that it takes for an egg to be able to be released can vary quite a bit. So I have some women that have the textbook 28-day periods, but many other people in my practice that only have periods that are 40 or more days apart. And since that window of when an egg is able to be fertilized is very short, it can be so difficult for some of these women to time it appropriately to be able to have intercourse to successfully become pregnant. And one of the things that we try to teach or do in the book is to have people know of ways to monitor for when they're most fertile. And some of the treatments that we have are also to try to speed the process of getting that egg ready to be released and to release up for some women.
Earlier in the book, in a portion of the book called Adjusting Your Lifestyle, you and your co-author set out some tangible bits of advice on the kind of lifestyle choices that that people should make. Which can by no means ensure, but improve the odds that they will be able to successfully conceive. I was struck by the fact that both in matters of weight and in exercise, that it appears that one really needs to try to achieve a happy medium, some sort of a moderate level of weight and of exercise, that if you go to one extreme or the other, then you are doing yourself harm when it comes to your ability to conceive. Could you talk a moment about that?
Sure. Well, we know that obesity is really at an epidemic level in the United States, and being overweight or obese can make it difficult not only to become pregnant but to stay pregnant. And so losing even a small amount of weight, and what I'm talking about for a small amount is really 5 to 10% of body weight. So if you weighed 200 pounds, for example, it could be as little as 10 pounds. And that's doable for many patients, but that could make a huge difference in your ability in order to become pregnant. And exercise is great. So exercise is okay before pregnancy, during pregnancy, and it seems to help women have an easier delivery and bounce back after delivery too. So we do recommend that exercise is good, but we don't recommend that women exercise to the point of exhaustion several times a week. So this, when you're trying to have a baby, if you're already in really good shape, you definitely can continue exercising, but this probably isn't the time to start training for your first marathon.
You go on to go into some detail on the best foods to eat, and of course a lot of these are fold into basic healthy alternatives to sometimes the poor choices we make. It's just mostly a matter of eating healthy, but with certain specific choices that can aid in conception. You also talk about things like going off the pill, at what time that point that needs to happen, and even the eternal question of boxers versus briefs, which reminds us all that the man is an equal partner in this matter of conception.
And that's true. So it definitely takes two to tango. And for anyone that's seeing a fertility specialist, one of the things that we're going to want to know right away is what's with the sperm count. So women are born with a one-time supply of all their eggs, but men manufacture sperm every single day. So it's important to see what the quality of sperm looks like on a given basis. And we care about not only just the number of sperm that are there, but how well they're moving and how normally they're shaped. Because you can imagine if you were in a factory where you made 100 million units a day, the quality control might be kind of poor.
And in fact, you have a really interesting illustration in the book of what slightly malformed sperm look like. And indeed, we see them and we can tell they're sperm, but they aren't quite a normal sperm. And evidently, even the smallest kind of defect can really have a significant impact on whether or not that sperm is going to be able to do its job, so to speak.
That's correct. And it's very interesting. If you look at sperm under a microscope, it's common to see ones with two heads or two tails or any kind of variation in between. And one surprising thing to many people is that you actually need only a small amount of normal sperm to have normal fertility. So when we look at their shapes, for example, we only need about 5% of the shapes to actually be normal and for men to have normal fertility.
Hmm. And, of course, we need to mention what's already been touched on in this interview, that when just normal life does not lead to conception, there is all kinds of help which is available now, and much of it inconceivable a generation or two ago. Just say a quick word about the kind of hope that you and your colleagues are able to extend to the person who has difficulty conceiving.
Well, I think one of my favorite parts of the book is the patient stories that are woven throughout it. So I individually approached some of the patients that I've been lucky enough to care for and asked them if they would be willing to share their stories with other readers in the book. And these are stories of hope and hopefully perseverance and inspiration. And we actually were honest. We included some stories where the journey wasn't always smooth, too. So not everybody got pregnant and easily had a baby and built the family the way that they expected. We also included some patients that had uncertainty or those who were unsuccessful. But to me, that's a very honest part of the book that many people can relate to, and one that I think people, especially that are having difficulty getting pregnant, since it can be such a private journey for many couples, I hope that these stories will really resonate with them.
The book, again, is The Mayo Clinic Guide to Fertility and Conception, published by Dacapo Lifelong Books, and one of its authors, Dr. Janie Jensen. Dr. Jensen, thank you so much for your good work and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your very, very interesting book. Best wishes.
Thank you so much.
The time is 8:27. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. Part two of today's morning show is a relatively recent morning show, which is being replayed by listener request. Before we get to part two, a quick reminder that on tomorrow's morning show, I'm delighted to welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, a director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College. He joins us once a month, of course, to talk about all kinds of different topics. And, of course, there are all kinds of things to be talking about with Professor Sear on tomorrow's program, including the nuclear control agreement recently brokered with Iran, the reestablishment of diplomatic relations with Cuba, the unrest which continues in the nation of Greece, and much, much more. We'll be talking about all that with Professor Sear on tomorrow's morning show. Now, part two of today's program here on WGTD. I wonder how many of you have heard of the intriguing notion of the six-word memoir, the notion of perhaps trying to summarize who you are or what your life has been in six words, no less than six words, no more than six words. This is actually something which has taken the world by storm, if you know about it, that is. And there's all kinds of people talking about this, deeply intrigued by the notion. Sermons have been preached about it, and whole books have been created around this intriguing concept. And the concept stems from SmithMag.net, Smith Magazine, which in and of itself is a wonderful place to visit on the World Wide Web to enjoy the magic of words and storytelling. And as far as I know, they have really hatched this notion and certainly nurtured the notion of the six-word memoir, gathering them not only from gifted, experienced writers, but from ordinary people. And these six-word memoirs can be read by the thousands, maybe the millions, on this website and in a series of books. The first one to be published was Not Quite What I Was Planning, a collection of these six-word memoirs. And several such books have been published, the most recent called It All Changed in an Instant, More Six-Word Memoirs by Writers Famous and Obscure. It's a paperback from Harper Perennial. And I'm delighted to be talking for the next few minutes on The Morning Show with Rachel Fershleiser, who is one of the editors of this book. Rachel Fershleiser, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Looking forward to this. First of all, maybe you can do a better job than I did of characterizing what Smith Magazine is all about. And what we find on your website, besides these intriguing six-word memoirs, which we'll, of course, spend most of our time talking about.
Sure. Well, Smith Magazine, it's online at smithmag.net, and it's really all about personal storytelling. So it's not just in six words, but it's about all the different ways you can tell your own nonfiction stories. And our tagline is, everyone has a story. So you don't need to be the president. You don't need to be some great historical figure to have an autobiography worth sharing with the world. And technology has made it so easy these days to express yourself. Not only can you write a six-word memoir in about 6 seconds and press publish and be online, but you can use YouTube. You can shoot a video of yourself easily and for free. You can make an audio recording of yourself easily and for free. So there's been a real democratization of media in the last few years, and we're just taking advantage of it to let everyone tell their stories.
I have to confess that this morning is the first time I actually managed to sit down and visit your website, and I really did enjoy everything that I saw there. I saw one thing in particular that was so intriguing. At the bottom of the page devoted to six-word memoirs from teens is something that's not at all limited to six words, but a very interesting sort of autobiographical story, I suppose, or self-description. And there's something about the format in which we begin with words starting with the letter A and then gradually to the letter B, and we kind of make our way through the alphabet. And I've never seen anything quite like that before. And it's just one more intriguing way that someone might choose to talk about oneself and share some ideas with the world.
Yeah, the teenagers has been incredible. You know, we originally started out doing this for adults. And when we made a separate website for the teens, it just exploded. They're more used to living their lives online than the adults. They've grown up with the internet. They're not shy. They're not afraid. And so where adults might submit two or three six-word memoirs, the teenagers will come home from school every day and submit 10 or 20 just about that immediate moment. And then they comment a lot more than the adults. They'll favorite each other's, and they form this real community. So we have this word cloud on the teen site, which is, I think, what you're talking about. And the words get bigger as they get used more by teens. So unsurprisingly, some of the big words are friends, divorce, breakup, school. You know, and so you can start to get a real sense of the ideas that are running through their minds all the time.
Oh, fascinating. I see that now, and that is so intriguing. How did your affiliation with Smith Magazine begin? I mean, what was your own road? And you don't need to limit yourself to six words.
Well, Larry Smith founded Smith Magazine in 2006, based around the idea of the story of the individual, the little guy. And I knew Larry a little bit because I was working in book publishing and he was reviewing books. And we were both kind of wordy, nerdy people. And when he started this website, I was starting to do more professional writing and I was interested in what he was doing. And so I ended up running the memoir section, the book section, because books are really what I know. And then along the way of thinking of content for the memoir section of this site, we had this idea to take the Hemingway six-word story and give it a personal twist, because everything we do on the site is not just storytelling like fiction or poetry, but it's really about the individual's true life story. And we got really obsessed, and it's really blown up.
One of the things I would love to explore with you is this notion of six words and the way in which this works so extraordinarily well. And I suspect that this has all taken off much more spectacularly than any of you would have ever envisioned. First of all, let's talk about kind of the kernel of the idea itself. Take us back to when this idea about 3 years ago was initially launched.
Sure. Well, a lot of people know the idea of Ernest Hemingway's six-word story. it's probably apocryphal. It's a legend that he was challenged in a bar bet to write a novel in just 6 words. And he wrote, "For sale, baby shoes never worn." And whether it's true or not, a lot of people in the writing world sort of refer to it, but not a lot had been done with it recently. And because we love individual storytelling, we started asking some of our famous professional writers to do it. That's how it happened originally. We asked published memoirists for 6-word versions of their story. But what we discovered is those weren't the people who needed it, because people who write whole books are daunted by telling their stories. But there are millions of people out there with stories to tell who say, "Oh, I'm not a writer. I don't know how. I'm too busy. I've got kids to raise. I'm a nurse. I'm an accountant. What do you want from me?" But once they started trying within these very simple restraints, then you could tell a whole story where you might be afraid to take a blank page, or who has the time or the desire to take a blank page and write a 300-page book. Some of us do, but some of us don't. But when I give you 6 little blanks and I say, "Come on, 5 seconds," suddenly we were getting, you know, becoming a rock star to forget her, met wife at her bachelorette party. And it was can't look at heart donor's picture. People were telling us these really powerful things that they might not find the words to tell us if they had to craft a whole book. But by adding more constraints, we actually found that people felt freed up to tell stories.
Isn't that intriguing, that constraints can be freeing? I think in some ways, I'm reminded of when my wife and I got engaged, and for a number of reasons, we decided to get married just a few months later. I mean, we were engaged in April, we were married in September, and that constrained us. It made so many things easier because you didn't have an unlimited array of reception halls to choose from or photographers to choose from. It sort of gave you a focus to your efforts. And in a sense, these constraints you're talking about here, for someone who would stare at a blank paper and not know where to start, this in a sense gives you a place to start.
Right. And for some people, it is just a place to start. Some people write their 6-word memoir and they say, "Wow, that felt really good. I wanna tell more about my life." And they'll take their 6-word memoir and they'll write a whole essay or even a whole book. We've had people write entire books that were started by a kernel of a 6-word memoir. And for some people, 6 words is enough. It's just a moment of self-expression. You can do it on the toilet or on the subway or on a lunch break at work. So I think we're really trying to propagate the idea that you don't need to have 20 pages in the New Yorker to be a storyteller. You don't need to have a book deal with a major publisher to be a storyteller. Every single person is a storyteller, and you have something to say that people are going to want to hear. Hmm.
One thing that is intriguing is that some of these 6-word memoirs really do seem to be memoirs that summarize a given person's life, or maybe the kernel of what has characterized their life and their life experience. And others are not really memoirs in quite the same way, are maybe 6 words that point to something very, very specific and isolated within one's life, or maybe 6 words that maybe point to a philosophy about how they live their life or whatever. Are you kind of intrigued by that or surprised by that as well, that not all of these memoirs are exactly memoirs in the way we think of that word?
Yeah, you know, some are really narrative and all-encompassing. You know, the famous memoirist Frank McCourt said, "The miserable childhood leads to royalties." Hmm. So you get the arc of his life there, from growing up poor in Ireland to becoming a best-selling writer. For other people, you'll get tiny little moments. My favorite ones are the ones that give you a tiny little moment that you can then extrapolate to a person's whole life. Alicia McKinney tells us, "Fourth choice to prom, still overcompensating." Larry makes fun of me because my favorite ones are always the ones from sort of nerdy young women growing up. I wonder why. but you take something like "Fourth Choice to Prom, Still Overcompensating," and you're taking one moment from her life, you know, maybe 30 years ago, and then you're looking at how that might affect or explain the everyday life of a person in the world.
One of my favorites from the book "It All Changed in an Instant" that is so chilling is from someone named Anne, who writes these six words: "I found my mother's suicide note." And on that page above it appears to be a photograph of suicide note.
It is. Which it's is a scan also, of the actual note.
Which is also six words. No funeral, no wake, no nothing.
It was incredible. We met Anne through the project, and we got that memoir, of course, and went, wow. And it's absolutely true. And her brother found the note for her to send it to us to put in the book. And she's done a couple of live events with us. And I think that it's a really interesting way to deal with things in your past, to turn them into stories and tell them to the world and kind of face them head on. And then, you know, some things are that powerful. And then we have, you know, "And She Lived Happily Ever After," Poppy Montgomery. Hmm. Or we have funny ones, "Love at First Sight," "Needed Glasses."
Yeah.
Which is both funny and sad sometimes, I think. But I love the, you know, "A Tiny Little Instant That Might Define or Explain the Rest of Your Life." Samantha Fillion says, "Kindergarten teacher sent to insane asylum." Which isn't necessarily a story about her own life at all. It's a story about someone else's life, but it intersected with hers at this one influential moment, and she's still thinking about it however many years later.
Hmm. Or "Left Behind, Friends Lost to Marriage." Or, on a sadder note, "Miscarriage, Age 15, Mom Doesn't Know."
I mean, I think when we started doing these, we thought they would be funny or pithy or jokey or cute. And the amount of emotion that people had been packing into these six-word stories are so amazing. "Family Portrait, Everyone Smiles But Me." Hmm. You know, that's not a conventional narrative, but it gives you such a picture of his childhood.
Describe what typically happens at these events where you and maybe another editor read from a book like It All Changed in an Instant. What do you say, or what exactly do you read? How do those events unfold?
It's tricky, because originally we were like, okay, we're not going to just stand up there and read straight through this. But they've turned into these really interactive events. They're so much fun. We'll start out by reading maybe the introduction and a few memoirs, but that's really not the bulk of it. The bulk of it is the six-word memoir slam. You can't just attend our events, because we're going to hand you a pen and an index card and make you think. And so while we do our little shtick, we'll have you brainstorming your memoirs. And then we also have contributors to the book. You know, the book has over 800 memoirists in it from all over the country. Some are famous writers, and some are teenagers and grandmothers and regular people. So we have a bunch of our contributors coming to the event. Some, I think, from as far as Chicago and Madison. People are driving in. You know, it's their first time being published, and it's very exciting. And so we're going to have people tell their six-word memoirs, and they're going to tell some of the backstory behind it. You know, either what led them to these six words, or what's the joke that we're not getting, or what's more of their life. And these events have been so much fun. We've done them on our last few book tours, and they sort of turn into something in between a support group and stand-up comedy.
Hmm.
And then we'll ask everyone in the audience to read their memoir as well, and we will bribe you with fabulous prizes, and it will all be very cathartic and entertaining.
Wow. I'm intrigued by the contrast between this and, for instance, so much of what we have on reality TV, which I'll confess I generally speaking can't stand, because, you know, in a sense, in many of these reality shows, you know, we have this camera hovering over someone's shoulder, recording, you know, every random thought and the minutia of their day and so on. And this, in a sense, feels like sort of the opposite. I mean, what could be more opposite of that than to simply have six words by which
right.
you express yourself?
I think it's some of both. In reality TV, there's a camera over your shoulder, and people say, oh, they edited me wrong, they didn't express me right. And what's nice about this is it's just your own words. I'm not editing them, I'm not changing them, I'm not recontextualizing them, I'm just putting them on a page. So you really get to express the part of yourself that you feel is most essential.
What about the fact that there is... I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
That's okay.
there is always a name attached, as far as I can tell. I don't think there's any six-word memoir in this book that says anonymous.
Correct.
Do you have any notion of how many of these are submitted with the correct name? I mean, versus how many people are making up a name and retaining some sense of privacy, even as they submit their six-word memoirs for potentially the whole world to see?
Right. It's hard to say. I mean, we're not fact-checking. But what we've found is that most people are so proud to have put their story out there. First of all, we've got hundreds of thousands of submissions on the site. And the 800 in the book are the cream of the crop. These people have been selected. They've been published. And so a lot of people are really, really proud of it. When we send everybody their contributor copy, we'll see people's personal blogs light up with pictures of their page. Oh, my God, here's my name in a book. And you can go to your local bookstore, and there it is, and you can send it to your mother. And, you know, depending on what memoir you've chosen, that can be more or less difficult. But I think that there's a real sense of validation in claiming your story and putting your name on it and putting it out for the world to see.
I think one of the things that's quite intriguing is how in many cases, and maybe we've touched on this already, people are sometimes expressing painful things that might otherwise be really hard for them to say. I think, for instance, of one of my favorites in the book, which are these six words written by someone named Anna Marie. Dad got promoted. I miss him. And we're left wondering if Anna Maria is ever able to express that feeling, that longing, that hurt directly to her father, or if this might be the only means by which she expresses that.
Right. It gives her an opportunity to say what she's feeling, perhaps to a different audience than she might feel comfortable doing it. It's also amazing how the six-word memoirs have let me know things about people I know very well that they might not have told me in other circumstances. My own father's six-word memoir that he submitted to me was 60, Still Haven't Forgiven My Parents.
Wow.
And it was very intense, and we talked about his childhood some, but, you know, I'm the kid. He doesn't tell me the deep-seated resentments. You know, his parents are dead, which makes it a little easier. But it opened up a part of him to me that I hadn't seen before, and we're very, very close. But it gives families, I think, an opportunity to talk about things they might not otherwise. It gives friends new insight into the way the people that they think they know well are thinking and feeling.
Hmm. Talk for a moment about the well-known names that pepper this book. I mean, by no means are they the majority. Most of what we read here are six-word memoirs by ordinary people we've never heard from before and presumably will never hear from again, but there are some famous people in these pages. You've mentioned that the project, I think, sort of began by giving this challenge to already established writers. Do these famous contributors come from that point in the project, or do you still get six-word memoirs from well-known writers and otherwise famous people?
We still get them. We definitely fight for them sometimes. You know, 95% of what's in here was submitted to us, but we'll reach out to people we admire sometimes, especially people known as memoirists, because, you know, that's our genre, and it's so cool to be able to take an ordinary person's memoir and put them next to Frank McCourt, who's a legend, you know, or James Fry, who everyone knows for getting the beatdown from Oprah over the truth of his memoir. He tells us in six words, "So would you believe me anyway?"
Yes.
And we've got Pulitzer Prize winners in here.
I like
Eunice
John
Diaz
yeah.
and Tony Kushner.
Right, John Grogan, that dumb dog sure paid off.
Oh, sure, yeah. And then, you know, Neil Patrick Harris and Sarah Silverman. So we've got comedians, we've got athletes, we've got writers, you know, just a little bit of every walk of life. And it's not about the celebrities, but it's very cool to be published next to them. And everyone's got six words. It's an even playing field. When we did the teenager book, the number of, you know, high school sophomores who freaked out because they were published in a book with Taylor Swift, it was like the most validating thing that had ever happened to them. So we like a little bit of celebrity. It's sort of aspirational at the same time as it's populist.
Well, it probably underscores just how neat an exercise this can be. I mean, not everybody, but I think some people might really feel like, well, if this is something Taylor Swift wants to do. Maybe this is something I should do, or whoever might be someone you admire.
When we started the project, we just had a few big-name writers like Dave Eggers and Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote Eat, Pray, Love. And, in fact, I think her next book is on sale today. But we had their six-word memoirs right up at the top of the page, and we were like, here are what these writers you love did. Now we want yours. We want yours just as much as theirs. We're going to put you right up there next to them. And, again, not everyone can write a 400-page book, but everyone can write a six-word memoir. We've all got one.
Hmm.
Or two, or six.
Do you have any idea what a contributor named J. Tony Smith meant when he submitted this memoir, I Am More Than Six Words? And, and I wonder if, along with that question, are you ever turned down, or do you ever find people who are sort of offended by the notion of summarizing a human life and all its complexity in six words?
I think people think it's really daunting when they just hear the idea. And then when they hear a lot of examples, they go, oh, yeah, I can do that. You know, we get a lot of memoirs on that idea that six words isn't enough. I can never be encapsulated. This is only the beginning. And a lot of jokey ones, too, where, you know, the sentence will sort of run off in the middle. But I think everyone knows that we know that they're more than six words and that this is a place to start. We've had a few, actually more of the professional writers and the bigger names be like, oh, I just have no idea. Oh, I could just never do this. And then when we show them sort of all the examples, you know, I'm a pretty wordy person. So is Larry. The two of us are these kind of New York editor verbose types and trying to become really good at this really sparse form has been educational for both of us, I think.
What do you think it is about the sparseness that can make it so expressive? And I suppose not in every case. I mean, I'm sure it's possible to write a really boring or rather meaningless six-word memoir. But certainly on the strength of what you show us in this book and much of what I see on your website, that it's possible to be incredibly expressive within the sparseness of this framework.
I think it's distilled. It makes you choose the most powerful words. You know, any writing teacher you've ever had will tell you to take what you've written and then cut all the unnecessary words. Or whenever you find a turn of phrase you're particularly happy with, that's probably the one you want to cut. And most writing teachers will tell you that you want the essential. And so when you've only got six words, you're choosing each one very, very carefully. And you know, the English language has a plethora of synonyms for every idea. And so you can really choose the one that has the exact right nuance, which I just don't think you have you're not as compelled to do when you've got more words to work with. You can waste them, in a sense. And here you know that you need to treat every word with a lot of care.
Hmm. I wonder if you could explain one matter that might seem kind of mundane to ask about. But as we see these various memoirs on the page, no two look exactly alike. That, for instance, you are using different fonts, different size fonts. Sometimes one six-word memoir will dominate an entire page. I wonder if you could just kind of talk about the physical layout of this book. And if you, as one of the editors, had very much to do with exactly how this book appears and exactly how these memoirs are delivered to us on the page.
Sure. I mean, at Harper Perennial, we have really amazing designers, and the book does have an interior designer who did the actual pages. But we talked a lot when we first started doing this book. Well, do we just want one per page? Do we want a picture with every single one? Like, you obviously don't want a book that's just going to be solid text of like 30 on a page and 10 point Times New Roman, you know? And I think that varying the fonts really helped. I mean, we're trying to get across the idea in a hunk of paper that this is not one voice. This is hundreds of voices. Each page has up to five voices. And so font, I think, is sort of the voice of print. So something small and italicized, like, I'm in love with my cousin, is almost whispered and secret, you know? And then you get something that's big and bold, like Texas cheerleader writes recipe for a revolution. Mm-hmm. So there's the idea that each one is a different voice, there's the slight differences in the voice. And then, you know, there's just variations. Some of the big ones are famous people or just ones that we loved. There are a few that have images. There are about 10 or 20 photographs, cartoons. We've got some really impressive cartoonists in here, actually. And each cartoon, just like each memoir, comes directly from the person who wrote the six words. We're not illustrating other people. So J. Tony Smith, who did I Am More Than Six Words, made a painting, and he scanned it, and he submitted it to us, and that's where we got it. So it's just another way of having the book be self-expression, of having the book be so many different voices, big stories and small stories and quiet stories and sad stories and loud stories. And I think very few people actually read the book straight through. It's really something you can dip into and peek at. You pass it around the dinner table at a party, or you leave it on the coffee table, and you can always just take a few, like a box of chocolates, you know.
Absolutely. We passed this book around as my family celebrated Christmas on New Year's Day, and that's exactly what we did. And now that I think about it, as I kind of replay it in my mind, it was like passing around a box of chocolates, and we enjoyed it very much. A quick final word about something that sets this book apart from its predecessors, the very end of the book and what we find there. Say a word about that, please.
Sure. We added an appendix for the first time here, and it's been hugely debated. All the books have indexes, which is fun, because if you want just memoirs about chocolate or hair or work or family or cheesecake, you can find that. But this book also has selected bios, backstories, correspondence, and conversations. And we go back and forth a lot. The six words say it all, or do you sometimes need a backstory, or do you want to know more? So it's not for everyone. It's just for a few. It's kind of quirky, but it'll let you know who some people are who are either a little more famous or have more of a story to what happened. Some of the memoirs, if you look at them and you go, who is that guy? It might be in the back of the book. And if you're a super purist who only wants six words per person, you don't have to read it. And if you're a super curious person, it just gives you a little more of an archive to dig into.
Very good. Well, there is so much to enjoy in this book. And, of course, I trust that as we've talked about this, we are prompting some of our listeners to sit down with a piece of paper. It's actually, you don't even really need a piece of paper, do you?
No, you can go to smithmag.net and you can submit your six-word memoirs there and be instantly published online.
Amazing. And in the meantime, this book, It All Changed in an Instant, More Six-Word Memoirs by Writers Famous and Obscure from Smith Magazine, is a paperback from Harper Perennial. Rachel Fershleiser, one of its editors. Rachel Fershleiser, I have really enjoyed this so much, and I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you.
Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general.